I suppose if Evan Lysacek put a cell phone in his pocket, researchers might be able to use it to track the path of his dramatic jumps, because researchers have been using cell phone information to stay tuned in to people's movements. A new study looked at people's daily travel patterns and found they are extremely predictable, even if people appear to roam around. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Laszlo Barabasi is a researcher who studies human behavior. One of the things he wants to understand is how much of people's daily routine is predictable. He knew that people with jobs generally spend most of their time at work or at home asleep. After all, his own life isn't exactly random.
So when I started this research, my expectation was, yes, of course, I am terribly regular. But I know that there are other people out there who are very spontaneous.
He and his colleagues got a surprise, though, when they went looking for those supposedly spontaneous, freewheeling people.
And the surprise was that I could not find those. At least the data was not showing those individuals.
Even though he had a lot of data to search through. Barabasi works at Northeastern University in Boston. He's been studying people's travel patterns using massive amounts of billing data provided by a cell phone carrier for a European country.
We don't have names, we don't have phone numbers, we don't have characteristics of the individual.
But they can follow an individual's movements, because every call must go through a nearby cell phone tower. His team recently tracked 50,000 people who used their cell phones fairly frequently.
Most people travel very little on a daily basis, you know, 5 to 10 kilometers or so. There were a few individuals who on a daily basis traveled hundreds of kilometers.
He had thought that the homebody's daily routine would be easy to predict, while the frequent travelers would be much harder. But his analysis showed that this wasn't the case.
We were seeing an average of 93% predictability across the user base. What does it mean? That means that for the vast majority of the people, you could in principle write an algorithm that could predict 93% of the time correctly their present location.
And they didn't find anyone whose predictability was below 80%. Barabasi says people lead all kinds of lives, rock star, company CEO, accountant.
Well, when it comes to our daily pattern, you're likely are just as predictable as the person next to you or the one who you think is much less or much more predictable.
The researchers described their study in the journal Science. Nathan Eagle is at the Santa Fe Institute. He recently used cell phones to study the predictability of people's movements around a university campus. He says this new study is impressive because of its much larger scale.
This is the first that I know of that really kind of showed it on a nationwide level almost.
He says studies like this one show the power of cell phone information for revealing large-scale patterns of human behavior. And major carriers around the world are now starting to share some of their data with scientists.
I think I've got one of the larger data sets, and we have now, I think, access to close to 500 million individuals, essentially, or at least data on 500 million individuals.
And he notes that worldwide, by the end of the year, the number of cell phone subscriptions is expected to hit 5 billion.
It's insane. I mean, the vast majority of our species are carrying around a little device that's continually logging their behavior.
He says this could aid public policy, helping governments make decisions about things like transportation. And scientists also have a new way to study differences across cultures. For example, he says people's travel routines may be predictable in Europe, but maybe that's not so true elsewhere. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Broadcasting from the same studio as usual, it's Morning Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Last month, Google announced that the hacking attacks it and other companies had experienced originated in China. Well, now, according to a story in today's New York Times, investigators looking into those attacks have linked them to two Chinese schools. One is a university, and the other is a vocational school. Reporter John Markoff, who covers technology and computer security for The Times, joins us from the paper's San Francisco bureau. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert.
And you report that the schools are Shanghai Jiaodong University and Langshan Vocational School. What do you know about these schools?
Well, the school in Shanghai is sort of the equivalent of the MIT of China. It has a world-class computer science program. The vocational school was started by a former member of the People's Liberation Army And it does feed students into the military. It's large, but it's more like a state school. It's not an elite school.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say the school feeds some students into the military. People had wondered if these attacks had not originated with the Chinese military. Does your story suggest that they didn't?
You know, I think we're still very much in a wilderness of mirrors. Google said they had some confidence that the intrusions came from China, but it did not give any meaningful detail. What was known before this from other companies that were involved in the investigation was that there were trails leading back to Taiwan, where some of the command and control servers for the intrusions were, and to a computer server center in Texas. And this basically takes the trail one step back, albeit to the Chinese mainland.
When we speak of this investigation, by the way, what kind of investigation is this that you're reporting on?
Well, I think that the visibility into the investigation is limited, at least by me. We know that Google contacted the National Security Agency and asked for help in the days after it went public with the intrusions. We know that law enforcement is involved, and we know that the companies themselves are trying to do detective work to find out ultimately where the intrusions came from.
You report that in one case there's been a link made not just to a school, but to a particular class taught by a particular teacher.
Yes, I mean, I still have to say that I don't know the name of the teacher. I was simply told that investigators had found some linkage to a particular class at the vocational school and that the class was taught by a computer scientist from Kiev.
Well, what have you heard about what I guess might be the most benign explanation for these attacks, which is on the level of student prank or misbehavior? Is the level of the attack such that they could have been uncoordinated by a handful of very gifted computer undergraduates, say?
Probably not. There are aspects of the intrusions that suggest great sophistication. And so the fact that the flaws that they used to gain initial entry were not publicly known, were not known by anybody, even by Microsoft. I mean, the initial intrusion vector was through a version of Microsoft's web browser. That is the kind of expertise that suggests a professional attacker.
So far as you know, is the hacking still going on, or has it stopped, or is someone lying low? What do you hear?
I have not heard of new intrusions, although people have found evidence of fingerprints, so there is forensic information to be gathered.
Are we likely to see any more formal public result of this investigation, or is it something that's likely to be kept quiet for a long time?
You know, I've heard this is extremely sensitive. The U.S. government is involved. Google has said that they intend to negotiate or discuss things with the Chinese, and I think what we will hear in a way, depends on the outcome of those discussions.
And do you know if the Chinese are cooperating at all so far in the investigation?
I do not, but I don't believe so.
Okay. John Markov, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's reporter John Markov, who covers technology and computer security for The New York Times. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Graphic and realistic-looking depictions of physical conflict may involve extreme and or realistic blood, gore, weapons, and depictions of human injury and death. That is just part of the rating for the latest video game blockbuster, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. In this game, players hunt down Russian ultranationalists using machine guns, sniper rifles, grenades, and missiles.
The world has been your battlefield. Everywhere you go, the blood of brothers and sons screams out against you.
Well, these days, there seems to be no shortage of video games with blood and gore or screaming or all three. And that got us wondering. We know how movies are rated and what the ratings mean, but how are video games rated? So we asked Jesse Baker to find out.
Jill Hing promised to buy her 15-year-old son the game Dragon Age for a good report card, but she was stopped by a sales clerk.
The person that was getting it for me behind the counter didn't want to hand it to me, and he said, "You realize that this game is very, very violent." There was a scene in it where the person was an assassin and killing just the general public, and I ended up not buying it for him.
Hing says she has better control over the movies her two boys watch than their video games.
I think it's harder to control what they play because they play for hours at a time, and I don't play them at all, so I don't know how many things they're seeing.
This is exactly why the Entertainment Software Rating Board was created 15 years ago. Patricia Vance is its president.
I think it became apparent to the industry that they needed a rating system to help parents distinguish between those games that were really intended for kids and those that weren't.
Now, big box stores will only sell games that have been rated, and the publishers pay for the privilege. Each game is evaluated by a small group of anonymous raters who aren't allowed to talk to each other during the process. This is one of those raters playing the new Batman game.
It's round two!
First, the raters review a package and DVD put together by the game's publisher, with scenes illustrating the plot and any hidden tricks.
Long night, Jim.
Joker invades City Hall and holds the mayor hostage, leaving it to me to juggle SWAT teams, the media, and you.
Each raider settles on one of six ratings and then compares notes to reach a consensus. It would take raiders months to play out all the possibilities. This way, it enables the board to assign some 1,700 ratings a year. And they don't stop there. Vance says parents want more than just a rating on a box.
They really want to know why it got that age rating. And that's why the content descriptors are so important.
Descriptors like simulated gambling, tobacco reference, blood and gore. The raters take it even a step further. They write summaries with examples of sex, violence, and language found in the games. The detailed descriptions are available online and through a new iPhone application. And according to the Federal Trade Commission, the video game industry does a better job shielding kids from violence than the movie and music businesses. For NPR News, I'm Jesse Baker.
Video games are big business, in part because games like Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 allow players to engage in warfare with other players elsewhere in the world, virtually. It's called online gaming. Sometimes players are on headsets talking to one another, and some of what happens in that virtual theater of war caught the attention of Jeff Bacalar. He writes about video games for the website CNET, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Robert. Thanks for having me.
And we've heard about all the considerations that go into rating games, but you say part of the potential problem with gaming is what the players themselves do. What's going on?
Unfortunately, the online experience is not always as benign and friendly as you might imagine. There's actually a lot of instances of homophobia, racism, and misogynistic attitudes going on online. And unfortunately, it isn't as discussed as much as the actual game ratings themselves.
You're not talking about what comes from the game. You're talking about what the players say as they are playing the game.
Exactly. It's all about the actual online interaction of players in this virtual world.
But it almost seems to me that what you're describing is an atmosphere that gives rise to, let's say, the verbal equivalent of a bar fight without any physical risk. People start getting abusive and insulting in their disappointment of what's happened in the game. And on the other hand, the person they're insulting could be 5,000 miles away.
Exactly. I think that's a great analogy. There's no physical consequence when you are sitting on a couch talking into a headset, and the person that you could be offending or verbally assaulting could be thousands of miles away.
Now, I think a lot of non-gamers right now are they're wondering, in an environment in which the game consists of killing people, it seems almost quaint to worry about what people are saying as they're killing. This would be an uncivilized environment.
Yeah, I definitely think the content of the game lends itself to that sort of aggressive behavior. But you do find this sort of thing happening in sporting games and in other games where there's a heavy sort of competition. In the heat of the moment, people become very passionate. And unfortunately, it does sort of lend itself to these sort of negative results.
Well, if the problem is not so much with the video games, as you see it, as with the gamers, is there anything that the video game companies can do or are doing to try to discourage this?
There are things, and the most popular online internet service, which is called Xbox Live, does have an entire section of their department devoted to combat that sort of behavior online. And I was able to talk with the head of that department for Microsoft's Xbox Live, And players can take action against those people who are violating their terms of service, whether it be misogynistic tones or racist, what have you. There are rules in place. There are provisions that allow you to report these incidents that happen.
But I'm not quite sure I follow because I'm not a gamer. If I'm playing a game and there's some player whom I only know of as a polar bear, and he is spewing a racist invective at me or another player, can I call in the ref somewhere at Microsoft at that moment in real time and say, "This whoever this is, this polar bear, shouldn't be allowed to play"?
You absolutely can. However, that sort of mandate will not come down until the powers that be at Xbox Live investigate the situation. So there really is no sort of instant gratification, sort of the ban comes down right away. It's something that the heads at Xbox will have to take into consideration after they've reviewed all elements of the incident. So to answer your question, no, there's no way to do it in real time. You can file the complaint in real time. However, it won't be addressed until some hours after.
Jeff, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
It's Jeff Bacalar, who writes about video games at the website CNET. This is NPR.
Once you've got your fancy new TV and you're ready to download a movie or your favorite TV show, you face the question of how much you will pay. Apple is shaking up the media world with plans to cut the price it charges for network TV shows sold through iTunes. Here's NPR's Richard Gonzalez.
The first shoe to drop came last week when CBS said it may offer shows as a test for 99 cents per episode. They currently go for $1.99 on iTunes. But other network execs are reportedly skeptical. Michael McGuire, a media analyst at Gartner Research, says TV bosses are having to weigh the value of their content and the size of the iTunes customer base.
There is a pretty big number Apple has in its favor. Over 100, 150 million active credit cards on account.
Among the questions currently up for debate, how does a 99 cents per episode price structure pay for actors, writers, and directors? And how many consumers will pay for a TV program they can already stream for free, although with commercials, on sites like Hulu? On the other hand, says McGuire, it's unclear how many viewers will pay for cable if prices drop.
As broadband penetration increases, I think you're going to see more and more consumers looking at their pay TV bills and saying, yes, I have 600 channels, but I really only watch 5 or 10. Can I just pay for the 5 or 10?
And McGuire says that's when the older distribution models like network and cable TV begin to show their age. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.